Next hour, thinking about how to prevent abuse. I want to suggest 8 strategies in preventing child abuse from occurring in your church setting. Now, we can't guarantee that abuse will never happen in a church, but what we're doing is we're trying to find ways to reduce the risk of abuse in church settings and strengthen the firewall around our children. Not all of you will be able to actually do all of these things in your setting right away. So part of this is thinking through then the specific application in your context and what's appropriate right now, and even things of thinking about what is my church ready for right now. But what I'm presenting is if I had an ideal situation, I think I'd be using all 8 of these in regards to protecting children. The first one you see there, creating and implementing a child protection policy. I'm going to spend the longest time on this first one since it's really the foundation for almost everything else that we're going to talk about. A child protection policy is a set of self-imposed guidelines that describes how a church intends to protect and care for the children under its care. It's an important part of fighting abuse is taking the time to plan ahead. That's essentially what the policy is. It's saying that we are planning ahead by thinking through what an adequate and safe environment is for our children. Now, I come from Washington, D.C. The next natural question is, what could be more boring and more bureaucratic than writing policy and guidelines? This is a policy not for the sake of bureaucracy. We want to create and implement a child protection policy because you want to define the parameters of what a safe environment for your children are before a problem arises in your church. You think about, and I laugh about this in Washington all the time, how a lot of laws come about, it's in reaction to a problem occurring. Well, we don't want to wait until a situation actually happens. We want to plan ahead and be wise about it so that we can do, in God's kindness, everything we can to protect against it. So hence, the conversation about prevention. What's in a typical child protection policy? Well, the context that you have in your own local church, the facilities that you're dealing with, the size of the church are going to create differences in policy, but a basic child protection policy might include the following things. The vision and mission for children's ministry, the parameters for the policy, a personnel summary, then you see their general guidelines and expectations for all staff and volunteers, training and screening procedures, expectations for classrooms, which include the 2-adult rule, adult-to-child ratios, appropriate and inappropriate discipline, appropriate and inappropriate physical touch, food and drink guidelines, and then the protective rules and safety guidelines, sickness versus wellness guidelines, check-in and check-out procedures, restroom procedures, transportation guidelines, off-site or out-of-town event guidelines, emergency response plans and evacuation procedures, a plan for preventing, reporting, and responding to child neglect and abuse, and guidelines for how a church handles sexual offenders who regularly attend and join the church, and a duty to warn policy. Appendices, examples of things that you can stick in there, you see signs and symptoms of abuse, code of ethics for leaders, staff, and volunteers, sample of the screening application and all the children's ministry forms that you use in incident reports, medical consent, transportation consent, and then state guidelines for mandatory and permissive reporters. You put guidelines into your CPP only if they have a clear purpose. You don't add rules just for the sake of having rules. A child protection policy might say something like, children under the age of 5 must be taken to the restroom by a female only. Well, why is that? Well, most sexual predators are usually men. So we want to have the most vulnerable children taken to the restroom by women, not men. Granted, many of the guidelines have nothing to do with child abusers, like maintaining universal precautions to protect against sickness or limiting food available in the nursery to protect children with allergies. And yet we want to make sure the rules and guidelines we have in there have a purpose behind it. In regards to child abuse, there are two general principles that should typically undergird your child protection policy. First, the risk of abuse increases when a child is isolated with an adult. Many offenders look for privacy in order to commit abuse. So try to ensure that an adult is never isolated with children. The second, the risk of abuse increases as accountability decreases. If an adult is alone with a child, there is no accountability from another adult. Or if a children's event occurs without any knowledge of the leadership or staff, then there is no accountability from the church as a whole. Both principles can help your church to assess the level of risk in any particular situation and then implement your policies in a way that makes children's ministry at our church a safer place for the actual kids that come to our church. So I've listed risk-lowering factors will include the following. Increasing the number of adults present, hosting children's ministry activities on church property rather than a private home, hosting at a time when more people will be around, increasing the visibility of adults and children, organizing the setup such that there are clear physical boundaries that fence in childcare workers and children and keep out everyone else, cultivating a personal knowledge of the character and integrity of the staff and volunteers, ensuring that staff and volunteers have participated in the church's training and screening procedures, including a background check and references, fostering a high degree of openness about children's ministry classes and events, and requiring approval of children's ministry activities by church leadership or staff. We cannot ever completely eliminate abuse from this world, but we can be deliberate in taking steps to lower the risk of it in our churches. For example, I want you to contrast the following two scenarios. Scenario number one, two unrelated adult teachers are present in a children's class that occurs at 9:30 a.m. on Sunday morning. The top half of the Dutch door is left open at all times. The class meets in the main building of the church, and there are other classes going on simultaneously in the same hallway. Scenario number two, on this first scenario, we would consider this a low-risk situation. Why is that? Well, first of all, two adults are present, so the children are not left alone with one adult. The adults are unrelated, since spouses and siblings are often unwilling to report on a relative, and sometimes, even worse, conspire together to harm children. And because the class occurs at 9:30 on a Sunday morning in the main building for the children's ministry wing of that church, there are plenty other people around, including adults who stop by the class to pick up the attendance sheet or a hall monitor who checks in with the teachers to see if they need anything. There you see scenario number two. A married couple hosts a game night for youth at their home on a Friday night at 6 p.m. Parents are encouraged to drop off the kids and told they don't have to stick around, and the husband and wife have neither been trained nor screened by the staff. We would consider this a much higher risk situation. The adults are related to one another. The parents drop off the kids, and no one else actually is around to hold this married couple accountable. The staff has not checked into the background of the couple, and yet they're still given direct access to the kids. The event occurs in a private home rather than a church, which also increases our level of risk. In real life, it's inevitable that some situations will be less than ideal. We just can't avoid that. So our goal is to find ways to lower the risk level of abuse. For example, at the youth game night, we'd lower the risk by asking a few parents to just simply stick around. Or by making sure the staff know about the event. Or by asking the couple to go through the church's training and screening procedures before they host a youth game night. The general principle that undergirds this is, in order to keep our kids safe, we must always decrease isolation and increase accountability. That's the golden two words in my mind. The golden phrase. Decrease isolation and increase accountability. Decrease isolation and increase accountability. If there's only one thing you remember the whole morning, just take away that phrase. And then you can apply that in your own specific context. Decrease isolation, increase accountability. That alone is going to start helping you think about how to create a safer environment for the children. Well, after you've written a policy, or if you already have a policy, there is always the question of implementation. A policy is not helpful if we don't find a way to execute it effectively. A CPP should not be an arbitrary set of rules and guidelines. If no one cares and no one follows it, the policy is just doing you no good. Just don't have a policy like that. In fact, you actually get yourself in more trouble in regards to liability if you have a policy that no one is actually following. A CPP should actively define how your children's ministry operates. Leaders, Sunday school teachers, childcare volunteers should generally know what's in it and should be working to actually follow the guidelines. Legally, if your church is negligent in providing a reasonable level of care or adhering to the policies, the church is more vulnerable to lawsuits and carries the greater liability. As one set of experts state, policies create a self-imposed duty of care. As a result, failure to keep policies can help establish the basis of negligent supervision. The best way to implement a policy is to make sure the leadership of the church is on board with what you're doing. Don't implement a policy that you know the church is going to have a hard time with without having made sure the leadership is completely behind you. It's a recipe for you getting in trouble. Take time to educate the congregation and the leadership about the problem of abuse and what and why on the specifics of the policy. Some of you will experience resistance to the policies. For example, folks who've already been serving in children's ministry and think it's unnecessary to have a background check. I've been here for years. In fact, I've been at this church much longer than you've been around. You're telling me I need to do a background check now? You're crazy. Well, that's not me making something up. That's the kind of pushback that a lot of children's ministers tell me they get when they try and think about implementing policies in a church culture that's not used to it. So you're going to need the support of church leaders and the congregation as a whole in order to enforce any guidelines you decide to come up with for your child protection policy. Number two, you see their check-in and check-out process. Of the strategies I'll mention today, this one will probably be the most obvious, but it begs to have a little bit of explaining. Churches should have a clear check-in and check-out process for children in the church. Why is that? What's the point? Well, check-in and check-out procedures create a fence around the children, allowing them to safely reside in the care of the church until they're given back to their parents. I've listed three goals for any check-in and check-out process in children's ministry. The first, you want to make it clear when the child is under the care of the children's workers and when the child is being returned to the responsibility of his parents. When a parent checks his son in and hands him over to the teacher in the classroom, that moment marks the point where the children's ministry team and the church has officially taken responsibility for that child. When is the child no longer the responsibility of the children's ministry staff and the volunteers? Well, it's after the parent checks the child out and receives the child back into his or her care. Without a clear check-in process, the line of responsibility actually becomes fuzzy. So for liability's sake alone, it's good to make sure there's a clear and distinct line, just as distinct as possible. Second, you want to give volunteers an organized system that matches children with parents and vice versa. For example, you could use the system of numbered wrist bracelets, where one bracelet goes on the child's arm, the other bracelet goes on the parent's arm, and if the volunteer were not sure if he was giving the right child to the right parent, the check-in system would provide a way of ensuring he wasn't doing something wrong. Now, you know, in our church, we are actually in a highly transitional environment. So our congregation turns over 15 to 20% a year of the congregation, which means our volunteer force turns over frequently. Folks don't know each other as readily, which means this becomes very important to us, because a volunteer might be standing there and he has 15 or 20 kids in the class, and the parents dropped him off, but he doesn't recognize every face and which faces belong to which children. And so what you're doing is you're giving them a system to match up which child belongs to which parent. And that's just a kindness to your volunteers to have something like that in place. Third, you want the system that can help you stop a child from being turned over to someone who is not the rightful guardian. Imagine if an estranged mother who no longer has guardianship of the son comes to church during the church service to check out her son while the rightful guardians, the foster parents, are in the service. Why does she do this? Because she knows the court system are not giving her access anymore. So that's a way to get a hold of her son. It's to trick the church. Well, that was an actual real scenario that a church told me. And fortunately, because of their policies and procedures, they were able to catch it and prevent it from happening. But think about your own church setting. Would your own church, with its guidelines, be prepared for a situation like that? The estranged mother couldn't get the child legally through the court, so she was trying to trick the church into giving the child over to her. So you need a system that'll prevent the child from being turned over to the wrong person. Number three, probably what is labeled the most unusual strategy for children's ministry, church membership. My strategy might surprise you. Involving church membership. What is it? Church membership is a self-conscious commitment to a local body of believers who are devoted to Christ and committed to one another. Two reasons why I want to argue for church membership and why I think it's actually relevant to our conversation. Number one, first, the church membership process gives church leaders and staff and other members a chance to get to know people before they join the church, rather than giving them immediate access to the church and consequently the church's kids. Number two, a careful, deliberate membership process can help decrease the likelihood of sexual offenders infiltrating your children's ministry. A church membership process causes pedophiles to think twice about joining, especially since there are other churches that don't require this at all and will give them almost immediate access to children. Now, in my denomination, which is the Southern Baptist Convention, there's a wide variety of ways in which a Christian can actually choose to join a church. Some churches allow people to walk an aisle at the end of a service, profess faith in Christ, the pastor has the church vote right there, And right there, they're able to join. Right there, they're a member. That's all it took. And from then on out, they gain access to all the ministries of the church, including the children. Really, it's that simple in some congregations. They just need your name, your profession of being a Christian, and basically they let you in. Now, I want you to have a contrast. Consider the church with a more extended membership process. To join, you need to actually go through a 7-week membership class. And then even after that membership class, you go to a one-on-one, one-hour interview with one of the pastors who actually cross-examines you about your background and your testimony and your understanding of the gospel. The pastor's trying to assess if you're making a credible profession of faith that matches up with your life and your testimony. The church's membership is supposed to be made up of real Christians, born-again believers, regenerate people. And that's true believers. So people who don't just talk the talk, but walk the walk. Now, which would a sexual offender gravitate to more quickly? The low wall of just walk to the front altar call church, or the high wall of slow down, let's help you make sure you're a genuine believer, and let's help you make sure you understand the expectations of leadership of being a part of this church. Again, Anna Salter, a nation's expert in this, has said, I don't find that most pedophiles are looking for a challenge. Most are looking for an easy target. If a pedophile had to climb over the low wall or a high wall, my bet is he'd choose a low wall almost every time. So as we've seen so far, child abusers are very deliberate, and their goal is easy access to children. If the Join Right Now church allows them to join this Sunday and then be all involved in children's ministry the very next week, why bother with the churches that have the longer membership process? Strategy number 4, screening and verification. Child abusers build their whole lives around lying. They put on the persona of a nice guy just to get access to children, to earn their trust and sometimes that of the church community so that they can repeatedly abuse those children. You might think you'll be able to spot this if it happens in your church. But the success of sexual offenders, many of whom offend dozens and dozens of kids, show that most of the time they'll get away with it long before anyone figures it out. So what are we going to do? Our inability to detect the lying points to this fourth strategy, screening and verification. Most sexual offenders assume churches won't check on them. And you know what? Most churches don't. If they did, they would find a trail of children and ruined lives. But too many child abusers continue offending because churches don't do their due diligence in verifying and screening staff and volunteers. Experts say that the most common way that perpetual liars are detected are either when they self-contradict or an outside source verifies that they're lying. And it's that latter reason why we have screening procedures to verify if the person is lying to us. In order to have an effective screening and verification process, a church will want to consider a number of tools, including written applications, references, interviews, background checks, and possibly even fingerprinting. A successful screening and verification program depends on employing a multifaceted approach. And not just one or two of these means. Because of our limited time, I'm going to focus on particularly background checks. All of the others I've gone into more in depth in the book, which you can reference later on. Criminal background checks allow the church to use law enforcement and other government databases to check on a person's background. Someone might ask, is a criminal background check really necessary? It's a bit extreme. Do we really have to go that far for children's ministry in our church? Well, ideally, criminal background checks will be done for everyone who volunteers and has direct access to the children in the church. I give three reasons for this, why I think that's a good standard for our churches. Number one, many children and youth service organizations mandate criminal background checks for their staff and volunteers. And if that's the case, churches should actually take the lead. Why do churches that place such a high value on children, and because of our biblical values of loving children and understanding how precious they are, create a lower standard of protection and care compared to secular organizations? If the secular organizations do this, why wouldn't churches do this also? Second, churches that mandate criminal background checks for all volunteers would be in a much better position to defend themselves in court against accusations of negligence in particular. And third, criminal background checks also reveal other types of behavior that might disqualify a staff member or volunteer from working with children or youth, like domestic violence, drunk driving, weapons violations, and in the case of which I didn't realize, traffic violations, like your tickets. I've learned more about speeding tickets of church members through screening children's ministry applications than I think any staff pastor in our church. Now, if someone has never been convicted, has evaded registering in his or her community, or is currently on trial in a local court, that person won't have anything show up on their background. Since criminal background checks typically only reveal convictions, they should not be a substitute for actually knowing the people that you put in positions of responsibility with children. Strategy number five, building design. In the first hour, we described two types of sexual predators. The power predator, who uses sheer force to abduct and overtake their victims, and the persuasion predator, who puts on the fake persona in order to get access to children. Most of our time has been focused on the persuasion predator, but this fifth strategy considers how we can guard against more so the power predator. How do we set up our children's ministry wing to keep separate those who should have access to kids, the approved staff and volunteers, and those who should not have access to kids, strangers and other folks who wander around? Well, in regard to building design, we desire three things in our children's ministry wing. Number one, we want clear boundaries that fence in the kids and approve volunteers, and keep out those who should not have access to kids. Clear boundaries would lead to natural divisions of space between these two groups. Number two, I want to make sure there are no isolated areas in our children's department. So is there a space in a classroom where an adult or a child can be together without anyone else around? Is a children's class or activity set up in a place that is too far away from the rest of the church's activities? Is there a remote room or setup that makes an adult more secluded with children? If your answer is yes to any of these questions, you want to get rid of the classroom or the setup in your children's ministry wing that makes children more vulnerable. And then number three, we want to make sure there is unobstructed visibility into all the children's classrooms. If a teacher or volunteer can shut a door and no one can see what's going on inside, we've put the children in a vulnerable position. We've put that child in jeopardy. So simple things, such as just adding a line of sight into the classroom, will make the church a safer place for children. Three kinds of structural setups frequently characterize churches. I'll break this down into what I think is ideal, the second best option, and the worst of the three options. And I've provided diagrams there for you to see what I'm actually talking about, so you can visually see what I'm talking about. The building designs considered below are particularly for the youngest children. So I'm thinking more so the most vulnerable and youngest children in the church, the 0 to 5 years of age, because those children are the most vulnerable children in your church body. The ideal setup involves walls that separate the entire children's ministry wing from the rest of the church, with some kind of centralized check-in desk, which all the volunteers and children must pass through. Anyone looking at that setup immediately gets the message, you're not getting in here without passing through this check-in first. Our next best option would be a long hallway with classrooms that are marked off by half doors, or they commonly call them Dutch doors, at the entrance of every classroom. That half door option allows you to put a boundary between the parents in the hallway and the teachers and children in the classroom. And that provides considerable visibility because you keep half the top half of that door open. In my mind, the worst option is the unobstructed doorway, where children, especially the youngest, and any adults, just simply walk in and out. Honestly, for children's ministry, for the youngest children, that's a bit of a nightmare. Because the kids can just skedaddle in any direction because you've got that open doorway. So at the very least, the half door keeps the youngest kid, who are squiggly and wiggly and have all kinds of energy, it keeps them behind a barrier so that you can actually contain them. So the open door is just not ideal for a number of reasons, let alone adults being able to walk in and out and have direct access to the children. So in my mind, the worst option is the unobstructed doorway where children, especially the youngest, or any adults can walk in and out, or a doorway that can be shut with no line of sight directly to seeing the children or the adults in that classroom. Strategy number 6, training staff and volunteers. In order to care for the children in your church, you need a basic level of training that equips everyone who helps with children's ministry. The basic question we're answering is, what do the staff and volunteers need to know to do their job faithfully? What we don't want is the staff and volunteers to come, bore them to death with a long list of policies and procedures, and then set them loose into the wild and happy world of children's ministry without them really knowing what they're doing or what any of the guidelines are or how to implement them in the context of your own church. There are lots of things you should talk about, like vision for children's ministry, expectations for classrooms, childhood evangelism, but I just want to spend our time focusing particularly in regards to the things related to abuse and neglect. Some of the basic questions that staff and volunteers need to consider in regards to abuse and neglect. What do I do if I suspect or observe that a child has been physically, emotionally, or sexually abused? Who is the point of contact at the church if I suspect or witness abuse? What responsibility do I have to report child abuse and neglect to police or child protective services? Are there common characteristics of sexual offenders for which I can be on the alert? What happens if a child touches me inappropriately? How will the church respond to allegations or admissions of child abuse? How can I best minister to a child who has been abused or neglected? What additional care is required for a child who is in foster care? And how can I guard myself from accusations? What happens if a sexual offender starts attending our church? An important goal for this training is to develop a healthy level of skepticism among staff and volunteers. You don't want your staff and volunteers to make false assumptions about child abusers, but to be vigilant about protecting kids at all times. What kind of skepticism is actually healthy? Well, you don't want to make your staff and volunteers and different workers paranoid that there's sexual predators lurking around every corner. But you don't want them to just carelessly assume, on the other hand, that just because someone's a self-professing Christian, it's safe to give him and her responsibility for all the children in the church. So let me give you an example. A situation might not faze you the first time, but maybe it might not even bother your volunteers. But if it's repeated, it might have some caution we might have to have. Jonathan is a nice single guy who's been around church for several years. He comes to church regularly and has a few friendships in the church. Last week, when a child needed to be taken to the restroom, Jonathan volunteered to help. Now, that might not set off any alarm bells for you. It doesn't necessarily have to be because Jonathan might be standing in front of a kid who's actually screaming at the top of his lungs that he's got to go to the bathroom. So what did Jonathan do? He reacted like any volunteer. He rushed that kid to the bathroom before the kid had an accident. Most adults will rush a kid to the bathroom when he's screaming at the top of his lungs he's got to go to the bathroom. There's nothing to worry about, right? Well, what if in child care training you made very clear that only women are allowed to take children to the restroom? Okay, that's caution number one. If it only happened once, it's not that big of a deal. You help correct Jonathan, make him understand the policy, and hopefully it doesn't happen again. But what if Jonathan regularly took children to the bathroom? What if it was just a normal pattern? If he repeatedly took children to the bathroom, and if you were clear in your training, well, some alarm bells should go off. You shouldn't just pass this off and say, he must have just simply forgotten the rule. A healthy skepticism should actually lead you to say something. If a volunteer senses something might be wrong, the last thing he or she should do is dismiss it or ignore it. He should be wise and sensitive to the Holy Spirit's direction as he thinks about what happened and how he or she should respond. The two kinds of training you'll want is what most churches do, an entry-level training for all staff and volunteers who participate in children's ministry. But the more challenging version of it is what I think is the ongoing training. How do you keep equipping your volunteers and educate them and actually help them understand what they are to be doing in children's ministry? Now, you know, in our church, we have an hour or so training that every volunteer and staff member has to go through if they're going to have access to children. You know, in our context, usually a month or 6 months or a year later, volunteers are asking the most basic questions about policy. And I'm sitting there thinking, we put you through the training. Didn't you hear what we said? So there is that question of how do I keep making sure the volunteers understand the policies within our church? And I've seen all kinds of strategies from children's ministry staff, whether it being an annual luncheon where you do your best to create a really nice meal so all the volunteers will actually come, and we equip them again with the basic information so we remind them what they're supposed to be doing. Two, things that we've started to do, we've found structural ways to build in reminders of basic bits of policy so that it's more like a constant drip rather than a mass waterfall hitting them at one time. So one of our staff members in the prep for the volunteers actually serving that day takes one bit of information and just reminds them of it. It just takes no more than 2 or 3 minutes. But over the course of the year, goes through most of the policy in reminding them. And that just keeps an ongoing process of helping them engage in policy. different things you can use. You got to think about in your own context what's most effective in helping your own volunteers understand the policy, because they're not going to honestly remember everything you gave them in that entry level of training. In fact, they'll forget most of it, because you'll know that because they'll keep asking questions like, tell me again what the bathroom policy is, or did I just break a rule? Strategy number 7, equipping church leaders, parents, children, and teens before abuse happens. To fight child abuse, start with the leadership of the church. If leaders place a high value on kids, and if they understand the reality of sin in this fallen world, the implication is that they need to think through this plan before abuse occurs. If you're a church leader, the question is begged, do you have a plan? As Proverb notes, the simple man believes anything, but the prudent gives thought to their steps. Proverbs 14:15. So be prepared. Be prepared. Don't simply be reactive to the problems. Parents need to understand the problem of abuse. Children and youth ministry staff can equip parents by offering classes and reading materials. The first step in helping parents is to make sure they know how to teach and instruct their children. We understand from Scripture that parents are the primary disciplers of their kids. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 4 to 9, Ephesians 6, 1. So while sex education classes are mandated in public schools, it's a bit more difficult to do something like that within a church context. So I think the best strategy in equipping children about issues related to sex or sexual abuse and is encouraging parents in their primary role as disciplers of their children. Help parents understand what to say to their very own kids. Church staff should help parents to understand the dreadful nature of child abuse and how to fight against it. Teach basic things like answering questions like, what are child abusers like? How do they operate? Which children are most vulnerable? What kind of safety skills should children have? Who should babysit your kids and who shouldn't? What incorrect assumptions do parents typically make about children's safety? And by answering these questions, we're equipping our parents to understand the problem of abuse. The goal is to create a congregation full of parents who are ready when abuse happens, not a congregation full of parents who are ignorant and have no understanding of the way child abuse works. They won't be ignorant or reactive or caught off guard, but the goal is that they'll be prepared. Overall, what are pastors, church staff, and children's ministry workers expecting of parents? Well, we're asking parents to teach a positive, redemptive picture about the beauty of sexuality in marriage and the need to stay pure until marriage. We're communicating with children in a developmentally appropriate way what abuse is, how to prevent abuse, and what to do if something hurts or takes someone hurts them or takes advantage of them. Teach kids not to allow anyone to touch them in areas of their bodies that are covered by a bathing suit. Teach children that if they are abused, they should keep telling adults until someone takes them seriously. And teach kids modesty and decorum with one another and with adults. And teach kids basic safety skills at home. In regards to equipping children and teenagers, my suggestion for churches or Christian schools is to develop a child safety curriculum that teaches children in a developmentally appropriate way what safety skills are like, what it means to stay close to home, who to talk to, when a child is lost, what to do when other kids pick on them, like bullying, how to avoid strangers, how not to be caught in awkward situations, and for older kids, understanding how offenders think or act, what to do and who to speak to if someone actually abuses them. Now, a solid children's or youth curriculum will put all this information into a clear scriptural framework using biblical instruction and craft activities and other kinds of things that equip the children. We equip kids by teaching them beforehand so that they're ready at a moment's notice to face a problem. flee from abuser, or speak of abuse when it happens. Now you ask, does this actually work? Well, there was a Christian school who implemented a curriculum like this, only to turn out to find out that there was a child that was abused by an older kid. And after going through that curriculum, the child then spoke out. The curriculum worked on their part because they equipped the children. Strategy number 8, getting to know the people and resources in your community. If abuse were to occur in your church, what kind of reaction would you typically expect from the leaders and church as a whole? You'd hope the church would be humble enough to seek outside help, and yet what you too often find is that churches responding are self-reliant, prideful, self-righteous, arrogant, and protectionistic in their disposition. Pastor and author Jared Wilson comments, "A church must be honest about what it can and can't do. Too many churches assume help found outside the church body is by definition worldly, or that all problems must be handled totally in-house. This is foolishness. A wise church will make use of legal authorities if necessary, qualified and trained, build counseling services, consultants, and other things." End quote. In conservative Christian circles, there's often a paranoia about getting government officials involved, especially in homeschooling environments, where there's a living paranoia about anybody calling CPS because they're scared that the government will take their children away. But just think through this scripturally. Genesis 9, chapter 9, verses 5 and 6, we see that that God establishes the power of the sword for the sake of a reckoning when harm comes to human beings, which means he explicitly authorizes the government to protect, among other things, the bodies and persons of children. This is the state's job. And we can thank God that he's actually given someone the responsibility to have this job. Prior to abuse occurring, it's good to get to know counselors, CPS workers, or the police in your community so that when a crisis strikes, you know actually who to call. You know how to get a hold of that person. You know who to turn to within your community. Just imagine the shock when some of you actually contact a counselor or a CPS worker and face-to-face or on the phone or on an email, you say something like, "Our church wants to take the issue of child abuse very seriously. So we want to sit down with you and talk with you about issues that you think will help equip our church related to child abuse. We want to learn before the problem actually occurs." Most CPS workers would drop out of their chair. Churches never actually give that kind of phone call. And yet many of them are having to step into dreadful situations where they see the church failing. And though they are overworked and underpaid, would greatly desire to actually help and equip churches understand being in a better position of preventing child abuse in their own settings. So any questions related to the 8 strategies in regards to prevention of abuse? Yes, and tell me your name. Tommy asks about, in regards to, and we're saying particularly like background checks when things come up like felonies, prior other kinds of convictions, just different traffic things, tickets. Traffic tickets. Yeah. 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 Well, so, you know, part of this, the whole idea in terms of membership is actually you know the people in your congregation, or you do the best you can to get to know them if you don't know them as they become a part of the screening process. And some of the churches that I know in regards to getting to know the volunteers actually do interviews. We don't do an interview with every volunteer. I think our membership process allows us to get to know members really well. We have a culture where members are invested in each other. So it's unusual for someone to step up into the process that one of us doesn't know. But there are lots of things that are uncovered with a background check. I mean, there are people that I thought I knew, and then things popped up on the background check. Which means then, for me, if things show up that would at least put a question mark in my mind, one of the staff members is designated a role to review the information that comes up in a background check. And so it's not just a children's ministry worker. This is why I think it's important to have some kind of pastor that has an elder kind of wisdom to be involved in this process. And so what happens for us is the children's ministry worker, our full-time staff in that area, does the background screening as a part of her job. But if something is flagged, it shows up in my box. And we have a conversation about it in our weekly supervision meeting where I meet up with her and talk through the issues that she needs to problem solve that week. And in the screening procedure, then, if something shows up, I then, as a pastor in the church, sit down and talk with them. Now, the children's ministry person could do that, but somebody needs to have that role of using discernment in having the conversation and talking through it. So there's some things that you look at and you think, after the conversation with them, you think, okay, I can see, especially if some of those things showed up when they weren't a believer. Then it makes sense. I mean, they, you know, sin rules their life. They commit sin. Some of that sin means violating the law. And so I use discernment. But then you start using discernment like, well, were they an immature believer at that point? And they've grown in faith now. And they've grown many years now. And so they're at just a different place spiritually. Now, question marks start coming in is, well, did all that stuff show up when they were a Christian? After they profess being born again? Oh, okay, that puts some more red flags up for me. Then I need to actually talk to them, because then there's character assessments based on the fact that they're a believer in doing all these things, that I need to sit down and have some conversations. And now we're just entering into the realm of wisdom. It's one thing if there's just two traffic tickets versus there's prior convictions related to things like vandalism or some other kind of conviction, breaking a law. Well, then I need to have a conversation about it. We need to talk through what the context was. I might even need to do further investigation about it to make sure they're being honest with me. You know, in one situation, the person actually was dishonest in the interview about the conviction, and by the conviction of the Holy Spirit came back the next day and said, I didn't tell you the whole story. It just was a good reminder to me that, you know, they're being put in an awkward position to be honest about their sin. And so the heart is deceitful. There's a lot of things that can create confusion in this conversation. So pastoral wisdom and discernment, and just Christian wisdom and discernment, depending on your position, is needed in that interview. A third comment I'll make about this is, yeah, there are some convictions or some things in a person's background, even if they're an unbeliever, sometimes if they're a believer, that you might decide that it's best for the sake of children's ministry for that person to be able to stay above reproach to decide not to participate. And, you know, I'll say this because there are all kinds of things that will happen, like wonderful things like a man who was converted in prison for some dreadful things in his background, and I believe is actually genuinely born again from the evidence of his life. Yeah, there's pastoral wisdom and discernment from your staff in deciding, do we want to put him with the children? Or do we not want to? Does it help him stay above reproach because of his particular background to not directly work with the children? Because there are many, many other ministries in the church he can participate in. Because the reality is, if something were to happen and he's in the room, he's one of the people that people will point to first. So he's got to decide in that screening process if he wants to put himself in that position or if he wants to stay above reproach. And I can go down the list of situations which have come up in background checks or through the interview process that we've actually had to have a conversation together where 80% of those folks have decided, no, actually, I want to take this approach of being above reproach rather than putting myself in a vulnerable position. And I have that conversation saying, at that third level, okay, maybe I'm good with you being in there, but maybe you need to decide whether you're going to put yourself in, and that's a scenario I give them. If a situation of abuse happened in our children's ministry and you were actually in the room, would you be okay with being in that vulnerable position, the reality that people will point the finger possibly at you to be examined because of your background? Actually, a lot of people say, you know, when we think about it that way, I prefer to stay above reproach. I'm going to go and actually invest in all of the other ministries that's available in the church and just decide that this is the one ministry because of my background, actually, I'm not going to participate in. So we have a list within our church of folks who have chosen to do that. It's an internal list that we keep that our children's ministry worker understands based on the interviews I've done and mutual conversations that I've had with the person. And we've had, well, you can see, an open and honest conversation. This hasn't been something in the background. They just were simply informed by an email. That's just rude. But a kind of openness and honesty as we dialogue together and decide what's best for the church. There will be some decisions I need to make based on my judgment call. They want to participate, but I think it's wiser for them not to. And so on behalf of the children's ministry and behalf of the church, I have to say no. I don't think it's good for you to participate, even though you're eager to still do it. That's a hard conversation to have. And yet it's my responsibility ultimately as a staff pastor who oversees children's ministry to actually have that conversation. Sad reality when it comes to background checks.